Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, I'm Tom Butler.
I'm Brendan Duffy.
And I'm Tom Wheatley.
And you're listening to the James Bond A to Z podcast.
Join us as three lifelong 007 fans go on a journey of discovery.
We're on a mission to discover everything we can about cinema's greatest spy films.
By learning about the people who made them, in front of the camera and behind.
The James Bond A to Z podcast is in no way affiliated with James Bond, Eon, or the Fleming Estate. We've researched each episode as extensively as we can, but our information does come from a range of sources. We do our best to make sure the information is accurate, but sometimes we can get it wrong. If you want to correct us on something or add some more detail, email us at podcast@jamesbondatoz.co.uk.
Hello and welcome to the James Bond A to Z podcast, where we have reached the letter M, and to mark this momentous occasion, we have a very special guest. My name is Tom Butler, and as always, I'm joined by the kick-ass Mr. Brendan Duffy and the superior Mr. Tom Wheatley. Hello, guys.
Hello.
And our guest is...
Normally, you do those a lot more drawn out and confusing, so that's nice and succinct.
I just want to get straight to the meat of the episode today. Our guest is the writer of Superman, Red Son, The Ultimates, Civil War, Old Man Logan, and the creator of Kick-Ass, Kingsman, Wanted, Jupiter's Legacy, Supercrux, much, much more, and also the excellent new spy comic, The King of Spies. It's Mr. Mark Miller. Welcome.
Thanks very much. Good to see you guys.
Well, yes, it's obviously very clear from, or it's clear to me at least, from your back catalogue of work that you've got a big interest in the world of espionage and James Bond. Is that fair to say, Mark?
Yeah, I think it's... I was born in that amazing golden age where my formative films were really brilliant. You know, like, it must be awful to have been born when, like, you know, Mannequin or... The Cable Guy or something like that, you know, is like the, you know, the first movies that you see in a cinema, you know. Like, for me, it was The Spy Who Loved Me, it was Star Wars, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Superman, more than anything for me, you know. And Close Encounters of the Third Kind, you know, it's like Jaws being the first big film I ever really saw in a cinema. So I was like so lucky. And James Bond gave me a love of that genre forever, but then equally sci-fi, superheroes, all these things, I kind of love everything because my first experience of them was so great, so lucky.
What was your first superhero movie? Was it Superman the movie?
Actually, no, the first thing I ever saw in a cinema was Spider-Man the movie in 1978, mm-hmm. Right? And it was just, but Superman was out, I think, that Christmas, and about 6 months before there was a Spider-Man movie, which you guys might not remember, but it was actually, I found out years later, the pilot for the Nicholas Hammond TV yes. show. And they released it in cinemas quite naughtily. And what they did was they released it on the Friday night that the Bill Bixby, Lou Ferrigno, Incredible Hulk was released on television. And it was like Sophie's Choice for children. You know, I was like, what do? I stay at home and watch the Hulk? Or do I go and see Spider-Man in the cinema? And I went to see Spider-Man. But my brother lied to me for years, right? And my brother said to me, oh, the Hulk was amazing. I was like, Spider-Man's the best film I've ever seen, right? And he says to me, oh, there's nothing compared to the Hulk. He says, the Incredible Hulk had Spider-Man in it, and it had the Fantastic Four, the Avengers, everybody was in it. And I was like, oh, my God. Right? And I was like 25 before I found out he was lying, because there was no IMDb back then. You know, you can tell.
Yeah, they did that quite a lot with the Marvel ones, didn't they? I think they did a Captain America pilot film, which went on at the cinema. But yeah, much like the Spider-Man one, hasn't quite been remembered very fondly.
There are a couple of Captain America movies that nobody remembers, but there was one in the early 90s as well that, you know, J.D. Salinger, who wrote Catcher in the Rye, his son played Captain America. He was like the big screen Captain America. And he was actually really
I do
good.
Remember that one, yeah, but good. I didn't know, I remember at the time, I probably didn't know J.D. Salinger was, so wouldn't have been an interesting fact. But yeah, I do remember my dad making me watch that film at some point.
What I loved is that back then they would sometimes be really kind of specific about costume stuff. Sometimes they didn't care and they just you know, they just did an approximation. And then sometimes they went too far and they couldn't get Captain America's costume right with the little ears sticking out, because in the comic books he had little ears sticking out. So they put fake ears on him in the movie. So when you're watching the film, you see J.D. Salinger's son with fake ears as Captain America. It's amazing.
Well, that's my evening sorted after this.
Let's take it back to Bond then, Mark. Was The Spy Who Loved Me the one that you saw first at the cinema then, the first James Bond film?
Yes, and it was one of those things where, a bit like Enter the Dragon or, you know, The Omen or The Exorcist, you know, there's things that were talked about that you hadn't seen. You know, you were too young to see it yet. So Bond, I mean, it's crazy now when I talk to my children, they can't believe that you can't just call up anything that you want to watch, you know? So the idea that a Bond film being on a Bank Holiday Monday or something was an event. You had to wait till Bank Holiday Monday. And if you were out that afternoon, you didn't see it, you know? So, like, so I had to wait for Bond. So it was quite, I knew what it was. I knew roughly what it was. I knew it was a desirable thing. Like, I had four older brothers and one older sister. They loved James Bond. And so my first Bond was like going to your first football match or something. You know, it was a big deal.
Yeah, that's crops up quite a bit where when the original Bonds came out, that people would often sort of have a weird mishmash of the ones that they'd seen because it was just purely based on when they got around to seeing it, when it was on TV. But yeah, it must have been a really strange, even before video players, you couldn't just, there's no way to see these films. But they, I suppose they had the double matinees, didn't they, and things where you could go and see the last Bond film and the current Bond film, so you could sort of catch up in the cinema.
Well, see, I think I was maybe a twice a year cinema guy at that point, you know, so it was a real event to go. You know, I was seven when Spy Who Loved Me came out. And I remember desiring the car before seeing the movie and then being obsessed with getting the car. I got three versions of it, like the medium size one, the big one, and the very small one as well, you know. So like it was great because like Marvel UK was kind of starting about that time, so kids were getting into superheroes in my class. Kids became obsessed with Star Wars and everybody had the Lotus Esprit, you know. Like it was a brilliant time because it was a bit kind of like the way Pokemon was, I guess, 20 years later. Like kids were stabbing each other in the playground for James Bond info back then, you know.
So what did, once you'd seen Spy Who Loved Me, did you just start collecting stuff and anything Bond you were looking out for?
Well, what was interesting is, you know, Roger Moore at that point is like 49 or 50 or something like this, you know, and like I started dressing like a middle-aged man, like when I was seven, right? So I remember like my mum would always try and get me to wear my blazer to school and I'd be like, no, I'm not wearing a blazer, you know. And then as soon as I saw The Spy Who Loved Me, that was the closest approximation I had of a sort of James Bond cool outfit, right? Because my blazer was black and my school trousers were black. So I was like, well, this is pretty cool. It's like in a Bond style outfit. And I remember wearing a holster under my blazer and having a gun in the holster and everything, you know. So I just totally get into it. But I really admired the fashions and everything of it as well. I just thought the look of it was so cool and everything that I just... And you look at it now and he looks like a Tory MP, you know, but it was the greatest thing I'd ever seen when I was seven.
Was there anything in particular in the film apart from the car that really stood out to you when you saw it, something that really captured your attention?
Well, again, it's that thing everybody talks about where the first Bond you see is special, right? So you always kind of think of it as better than it was, you know, like everybody's era of music, everybody proclaims was the greatest era of music and everything, you know. So I'm always careful not to fall into that trap, but Spy Who Loved Me is quite a special one, isn't it? I think there's something, like the stars really aligned there, you know, like they really figured out how to do these things again, you know, like there's you know, been a couple of slightly wonky ones, you know, in the previous 10 years, but they just kind of nailed it. There's a great director, really good screenplay, a brilliant baddie, two brilliant baddies, you know, the great henchman and also the great Bond villain as well, a great headquarters, you know, with the idea of a sea headquarters just seems so outrageous. You know, you're getting into real comic book stuff then. You know, there was loads of stuff to act out as well. Like, there was great set pieces. And I'd never seen From Russia with Love at that point, so the idea of the fight on the train felt incredibly fresh to me. So my friends and I, we would act it out quite a lot in our houses. Like, regularly, it became a kind of thing where we would use a lamp in a toy fight that you were having with your friends, pretend you electrocuted your friends, and then kick him out of a lower floor window in his house into the garden, you know? And it was like stuntmen, you know, you would sit and work all this stuff out ahead of time and say, right, I'm going to kick you, I'm going to electrocute you, then I'm going to kick you, and you're going out the back window, and you'd set up something for it to fall on and everything, you know? So I don't know, would you do that with Tomorrow Never Dies? I don't know. But, so Spy Who Loved Me really had a lot of magic in it, I think. And Roger Moore in his absolute prime as well.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's a good thing to start on Spy Who Loved Me or a bad thing, because there's a few that you could probably watch after The Spy Loved Me and go, oh, so they're not quite as good as The Spy Loved Me. I would think one of Butler's ideas is that you start on a bad one and then it's all, the only way is up. But how did you find the what did you watch after that? Did you enjoy it as much or was it?
Well, remember, I had to wait till the next Bank Holiday Monday. So I think the next Bank Holiday Monday, I think I had another good one. I had Goldfinger. And then after Goldfinger, I think it was Dr. No, and then I think You Only Live Twice. So I think I saw them in that sort of order. Then I get into the more Roger Moore ones again. So I was really lucky that all the first ones I saw were good. So I'm actually quite careful when I show my children. I've got three kids, and I try and get them, like every dad, you know, I try and get them into all the things I love, but I curate it very carefully. So the first Bond I showed them was The Spy Who Loved Me, which they loved. Then I did Goldfinger, you know, and I pretty much showed it in the order I watched these things. And it made them so into it that then they could sit through ones that maybe weren't as good because I'd built up enough cultural reserves. You know, there was enough love in their heart for Bond by that point. But I'll tell you something, this will blow your mind, right? This will blow your mind. Like my 10-year-old daughter, she was 9 when I showed her maybe 5 Bonds in a row, right? And I flipped between Roger Moore and Sean Connery, just going back and forward, basically showing in order the ones that I thought were best to worst. And she didn't realise it was a different person until I pointed it out.
Wow.
And she's really clever, right? So it's not as if she's that, right? But she was like, oh my gosh, you're right, you know? And she looked, she froze it, and she went, yeah, this is a different guy. Because to her, it was just James Bond. And those two guys don't look anything like each other, but she bought into it so much. But what's really fascinating is I love watching it through children's eyes. As she said to me, when we watched Goldfinger, Bond gets off with 4 different girls in Goldfinger, right? So like at the beginning, she's watching it, he gets off with somebody in the pre-credits, and then he gets off with somebody else, and she looked confused, and she said, I thought his wife was that girl with the brown hair. And I was like, all right, that was just a girl he saw briefly. And then by the time it got to the 4th one, which was Honor Blackman, she said to me, how many wives does James Bond have? Which I thought was such a such a great perspective on it.
He's got many. He has got many.
A lot of wives.
So what do you think, Mark, would you say is the appeal of Bond generally?
I've got a theory about this, right? And I think it's similar to the superheroes, I guess, with American culture, is that Bond, there's been spies for a long time, you know, in fiction, you know, going back into the 19th century, you know, there's a lot of these type of characters. But detectives and spies and everything, you know, they've been around for a long time. But Bond, I think, just came along when Britain had lost its empire. You know, so Britain had lost its role in the world. It lost its swagger a little bit, you know. And then somebody comes in dressing like the perfect gentleman with a great haircut and, you know, the coolest cars, directed by British guys, written by British guys and everything, you know, and kind of starring British guys. And it actually made people feel good about the fact we'd lost everything, you know. So I think it's the same as the reason superheroes are so big right now is because America is acutely aware that in the last 10, 20 years of their empire, you know, they're starting to eat themselves culturally, you know, and it's a hard thing to watch. And I think that superheroes make you feel better because it's the ultimate aspiration of Americans, isn't it? You know, the superhero. Superman even looks like the flag, and he's the perfect immigrant success story, isn't he? A guy from another place making it work in Metropolis. And I think James Bond is that for us. And we love it so much it became contagious, and everybody around the world loves it too.
Let's go for a simple question, Mark, and you probably knew we were going to ask you this one. Have you got a favourite Bond actor?
Well, it's funny because the Scottish side of me, of course, should say Sean Connery, but it's not Sean Connery. and I think it's like Doctor Who, isn't it? You know, people's favourite Doctor Who is the first one that they saw. And for me, I think Roger Moore is James Bond. When I see Roger Moore, I think he looks like James Bond to me. And Sean Connery, I love. I love Pierce Brosnan as well. I love Timothy Dalton. You know, I mean, I think all the Bonds have been really good in their own way. But Roger Moore, he just ticks every box for me. But here's my thing where I feel good about saying Roger Moore. A pal of mine who's American had never, he's 48, he'd only ever seen the Daniel Craig Bonds. He'd never seen any other Bonds. And he's a big movie fan. He's a big genre fan and everything, but he never watched the Bond films. He said he never felt they were for him. I said, look, give them a try. And he actually started and worked his way through all the Bonds. And I said, right, who's your favourite? He said, hands down, Roger Moore. I said, Roger Moore's amazing. And he's not coming with any nostalgia or anything like that. He said, that guy's brilliant. He's perfect as Bond. He's funny. I believe him in the fights. I believe him in the love scenes. You know, he's great.
Did he do it in order? So he did all the Sean Connerys first?
I think he actually mixed them up. I think he mixed them up, you know, because he'd seen the Daniel Craigs and he was kind of mixing them around. He surprised me. He had some kind of weird zigzaggy kind of way of watching them. And so, but he said they were really satisfying. He really enjoyed this. They really stood up brilliantly. I think his movies, because I watch them quite regularly, you know, I think his movies, though, the Connery ones are quite hard to beat. I think structurally, in terms of direction, acting, you know, I think Connery's are actually technically better than Moore's. Moore's got a few that are a little uneven, you know, but his personal charm, I think, carries the movies so well.
Yes, he's definitely the driving force, isn't he? We often talk about the Connery ones being able to exist in their own on their own without being part of the Bond thing, especially something like From Russia with Love, which is just a great espionage film in its own right.
Yeah.
But the Roger Moore films are a little bit trickier because you need to understand the story. You know, you see J.W. Pepper pop up in the which is the second film he's in, Mammy Gone Good.
Yeah.
You kind of need a context for that, don't you, to understand what's going on with that. But yeah, Sean Connery's ones, yeah, we often say that they're really good in on their own.
Yeah, and I love that. You know, I love the self-contained movie. I mean, I think that's a real weakness in the Daniel Craig ones, the fact that they all tie together. And like, I mean, when I went to see the last one, I couldn't even remember stuff because it was like from 15 years before. And they're not very rewatchable. You know, like Bank Holiday Monday, you're never sitting down and saying, oh, Quantum of Solace, brilliant, you know? It's like,
So if you were to put a Bond film on, which one would it be?
Spy Who Loved Me. Spy Who Loved Me and Goldfinger, I think, are the two gold standards.
Right.
You know, they're brilliant.
Ah, you're in good company, Mark.
Yeah, but I do have a real soft spot for Brosnan and Dalton as well, though. You know, like, I feel Dalton was shortchanged slightly. Like, his movies, budgets were funny and all that kind of stuff. You know, like, he could have been a really great Bond. And Pierce Brosnan is so damn likable. You know, like, Goldeneye is a great Bond film. Great Bond film.
Well, Brendan's the world's biggest Brosnan fan, so he's nodding there, very excited.
Well, how old are you, Brendan?
35.
So Brosnan's your Bond then, isn't he?
Yeah, he's my Bond, yeah. And GoldenEye
is for all of us, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's not my Bond.
But he was the first thing you saw in the cinema, right?
Yeah, but I'd watched all the Bonds up until that point before then. It wasn't like an entry point for me, so I was already sort of associated with him. He's definitely, you know, I remember the excitement of going to the cinema to see him, but I think I still had a bit of a problem accepting him after being a big fan of Connery for so long.
So you saw Bond on TV before you saw it in the cinema?
Yeah, my dad is a massive Bond fan. So before, the only one I had the opportunity to see was GoldenEye, because before then I was too young to see any of them in the cinema. So
and the big gap, before it'd been out of cinemas for a long time, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. And even if you were just about old enough to be allowed to see the Dalton ones, you probably wouldn't, or your parents wouldn't want you to watch them because they're a little bit...
Yeah, but License to Kill had the 15 rating as well, didn't it? And we would have been 7 or 8 at that that point. So we'd really had missed out a big chunk of time of Bond at the cinema. But my first was GoldenEye, and for that reason, I hold it very close to my heart. But I would say that is a great Bond film, like The Spy Who Loved Me is a great Bond film, in that it really hits the formula really nice in a way that the film just sings with it.
We struggle to pick holes in GoldenEye, don't we?
Yeah.
Some that we don't struggle to pick holes
and
in.
And we haven't done The Spy Who Loved Me yet, so I think we'll find the same with that one.
I there's one scene I could live without, though, and it's the Die Hard thing, you know, because we'd just seen it in Die Hard 2, that strapping yourself into the ejector seat and getting out of the plane.
Yeah.
And I remember being like, oh, you know, that I've seen that before, and that's just my one complaint. I've got a second complaint with GoldenEye, though. And it's personal. And what it was I went to see it in Glasgow, and there was a French guy. You never see French people in Glasgow. But there was a French guy behind me who was telling somebody with him what was happening all the way through the film, right? So he was like, Bond is standing on the edge of a reservoir, you know, and he was describing everything that was happening, you know, all the way through the film. And it says, Sean Bean is still alive. You know, it's things like that. He was giving a complete running commentary to me, a guy he was with. I don't know if the guy was blind or something that he was with, but It's kind of weird watching the film now without this guy in my ear.
So you grew up with the Roger Moore films, Mark. Yeah. But then, as you grew up and became, you know, an adult, did you follow the Bond films from there, going to the cinema to see everyone?
No, I didn't actually. I went to see, you know, that weird age where your family takes you to the cinema, and then you're paying yourself. And there's a little window where you're about 15, where your family are not taking you to the cinema, but you're a little bit too young. You don't have the money to go yourself. So I missed Octopussy, and this is the weirdest thing. My daughter, my oldest daughter's boyfriend, is like the biggest James Bond fan in the world. And at Christmas dinner, we were sitting chatting about Bond, right? And like he said to me, well, you know, it was actually fascinating to see an Indian backdrop in a Bond film because we'd never seen anything like that before. And it was actually a full year before Indiana Jones is in India. You know, so Bond's, which normally follows cultural trends, was actually kind of setting it unusually, you know, like a year ahead, instead of following Jaws or following Star Wars or following Kung Fu movies or whatever. And I was like, I don't remember an Indian backdrop. What? And I'd obviously heard of Octopussy a million times, but for some reason it had slipped through my viewing and I'd never seen it. So Christmas night, he said to me, we need to watch this, you know? So I downloaded it. And I watched a vintage Roger Moore James Bond film, a good one as well, that I'd never seen. So it was like a gift. It was like finding Superman 2.5, you know, or an Indiana Jones film from 1986 or something. You know, it was actually amazing. It was like a perfect time capsule that was. I'd never seen a single scene from the movie, and I just ate it up. It was brilliant.
And you're a big fan of it.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. It was great. I mean, action is obviously directed in a slightly different way now, you know, but so you're not, it doesn't have the pulse racing thing that it would have had if I'd seen it in 1983, you know, but like, but it really stands up. It's a good film. It's a really good film. Louis Jourdan's a great bad guy and everything as well. So it's one of the good ones.
I remember, Wheatley, we were a bit obsessed with that one because of Roger Moore's stunt double on the train. Looks nothing like
the ginger one.
The ginger one.
Yeah. Well, you find this a lot with Bond films nowadays. A lot of films, but probably more so with Bonds. That when you watch them on a big HD TV, you start to spot things and go, they really didn't plan these to be on HD.
John Steed is my favourite like that as well, because by the time the Avengers has been made, the new Avengers especially, you know, like he's in his 50s. Pushing 60, and the guy doing the stunts is about 25, you know, and it's for some reason it adds to the experience for me. I kind of like it when a slightly bloated guy becomes a skinny guy for the fight and then becomes the bloated guy for the close-ups again.
I associate Roger Moore Bond films with the weird stunt guys they get into them. It's just part and parcel of it.
There is a charm to that, isn't there? Mark, have you seen the photo of Christopher Reeve on the set of Octopussy?
Well, see, this has actually haunted me my whole life, because you've got Christopher Reeve with his Superman 3 haircut, which is that slicked back hair, which I think is a wig, actually. And then you get Roger Moore as a clown, right? And I was like, what the hell is this? And I thought it was some deleted scene from a Bond film that I seen, because I was convinced I'd seen Octopussy. And then when I watched it was like my life all fell into place. Everything. That was my rosebud. But I was like, okay, now I understand why Roger Moore was a clown.
Yeah, there's some interesting outfits in Octopussy. Memorable.
So you hadn't seen Octopussy, and then did you follow on and see the Pierce Brosnan era through? Timothy Dalton. And then Pierce Brosnan. And
yeah, very exciting when Timothy Dalton got to be Bond. Like, it was a real cultural event. You know, there's a new Bond and a new Doctor Who kind of makes the news, you know. So I remember News at 10 when I was about 16. Showed you some footage of a stunt from Living Daylights. And there was a little bit of an interview with Timothy Dalton, who I'd obviously seen in Flash Gordon as well, you know, so it's kind of really exciting. You're like, oh, here's the new Bond. And it was the first time I'd ever seen a sort of new Bond coming in, because Roger Moore, I was so young when he became Bond. So it really felt like a big deal. It was like Channel 4 or Channel 5 luncheon, you know, it felt like a mass event everybody was talking about. And I was quite unaware of how it wasn't a big deal cinematically. Like, it didn't do that well, because everybody I knew really, they were just the perfect age. They were really excited about it. There was a new James Bond. And we were quite surprised and disappointed when License to Kill was the last one for a long time. We were like, what the hell happened to Bond? Because there was no internet to check Box Office Mojo and find out something hadn't really worked.
Do you remember when the announcement was made for Timothy Dalton? Were people, you know, like with Daniel Craig, him coming in,
yeah,
there was a lot of people who didn't want him to come in. Was that the case with Timothy?
No, very, very, very exciting. And actually, it was very interesting, like, especially like women who were about 10 years older than me, like I was about 16, 17, and women in their late 20s that I knew, like, and my family and friends, they were really excited. They loved Timothy Dalton. It was like he was the most handsome guy to play James Bond. And they loved the idea of him. So I thought he was going to be mega, you know. But the big thing everybody said was after seeing the movie is it wasn't funny enough and he couldn't land the jokes. But I do also think that what makes something work sometimes when you recast a character is to go in a different direction. So I think, for example, you know, Roger Moore following Sean Connery is perfect because it's light and shade, you know, you've got a very different way of playing it. And then to go Timothy Dalton was the correct choice, I think, to go a little bit more serious. You know, and then you've got the lightness again with Pierce Brosnan, but he can deliver a joke. He's really good at it. So you've got a Shakespearean actor followed by a guy who can do a quip, you know. And that's why I think somebody like Henry Cavill or somebody would be good now, because he's got the light touch. You know, he's got a likability. He doesn't look like a squaddy or a tough guy or anything, but you believe him in those scenes, but kind of like Roger Moore, I think he'd bring the lightness a touch. It's why I think Batman's casting is quite weird, because we're seeing the same take over and over again. It's like, imagine Sean Connery had been followed by somebody kind of like Sean Connery, who was then followed by somebody kind of like him. And I think that's what's a bit weird with Batman, because we've seen the same. Like, Michael Keaton was really interesting because he was nothing like Adam West. But then everything since is just a darker and more shadowy Batman. Whereas coming in with a light Batman again could be really interesting if it's done right.
So you're thinking a light comedian for the next Bond?
I wouldn't go as far as a comedian, but a guy that can land the joke. You know, like Daniel Craig is a brilliant actor, but he looks in physical pain when he's delivering the gags, doesn't he? It's like, it's so against. And, you know, it's so unfair on him because he was Bond for a very long time. I mean, he was Bond in time terms, the equivalent of Dr. No all the way up to like Moonraker or something, wasn't it? I mean, it was a preposterous amount of time.
It's the longest term, yeah.
Yeah, and cultural trends change in that time. But so he had to kind of provide a continuity because all these films were interlinked, but at the same time, kind of update it a little bit. You know, so by the time of the third or fourth one, people were wanting a gag. They didn't want it to be like Jason Bourne, but he was still unfortunately trapped in being Jason Bourne Bond, wasn't it?
Yeah, because he was in that arc, so he couldn't really wriggle free.
Yes.
It would have been a very weird, change of tone, wouldn't it, if they had gone for something a bit lighter?
You'd have to be careful.
Could die another day.
Yeah, exactly.
I'd love to have seen that, just the look on his face.
But you have to recast. If you're doing a new tone, you have to recast the thing, because you just don't buy it. There's something, like, when he was making those gags in Spectre, I think it was, you know, it just felt really odd, but it had a wee moments where it felt like a carry-on film. It was really tonally odd.
They sort of do that a bit with Roger towards the For Your Eyes Only film, where his tone, they do try and change it a bit. They try and make him a little bit grittier. They don't stick with it the whole film.
Yeah.
But I think I've watched that film sometimes and just at points thought, this doesn't seem quite right.
Yeah.
His tone's changed. I think he does. They gave up towards the end and just go back to normal Roger. But there's definitely, you have to stick with it. It's quite jarring when it doesn't quite fit.
Well, you just want to see Roger Moore be Roger Moore, don't you? And it's funny seeing him in anything else. I watched The Wild Geese again quite recently, and it's so weird seeing Roger Moore like murdering a drug dealer and things like that, you know? But it can be really exciting as well, you know, it can really work if he's part of an ensemble, but it was hard for him to escape being Roger Moore, like it's hard for David Niven to not be David Niven or Cary Grant.
Yeah.
Have you seen The Man Who Haunted Himself, Mark?
I love The Man Who Haunted Himself. It's Roger Moore's own personal favourite movie ever made, isn't it?
That's what he said,
I watched that years ago. I remember I went through a bit of a mad stage just buying any Roger Moore film and sitting and watching them. But at that point, I thought, I love Bond. I've seen Cannonball Run. I want to see some more funny Roger Moore films, and watched that. And I didn't know what was going on. I was thinking, when's the joke coming?
I did that with Deliverance, you know, the Burt Reynolds movie, Deliverance.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like,
oh,
I remember after Superman, I was obsessed with Superman, right? So I watched every movie that every actor in Superman made, or even things like the costume designer, you know, like I would track down films she'd made and things like that, you know, just anything to do with Superman I would watch. So Ned Beatty was played Otis, obviously, in Superman.
Yeah.
I was like, what else has he done? So then I saw Deliverance and I was like, oh, I need to get that out of the video shop. That's going to be amazing. And it was like, it haunted me for life. You know?
Hope you didn't watch that one with your parents. That's quite a quite a bleak movie, that one.
But Roger Moore, I know what you mean. And anything to do with Roger Moore, I just get into. And he appeared in Glasgow about a year before he died. He appeared that national tour he was doing. I'm sure you guys went along to it. And I went with five of my friends and we kept looking around at each other. And, you know, a couple of us are in the film business and worked with Brad Pitt or Angelina Jolie and all this kind of thing. But Roger Moore being on stage, we kept leaning forward and saying to each other, can you believe we're in the same room as Roger? This is amazing. Yeah. You know?
Did he was talking to, when we saw it, he was just talking to the audience and just completely relaxed, just enjoying it. It was amazing to see. It's, he's one of those people where he's so approachable and so likable.
Yeah.
But you also almost don't see him as a real person
because
he's so, you know, so high up there. But it was phenomenal to see.
But what I loved as well is he was at an age where he doesn't care anymore about what he says.
Yes.
And also from a generation of people who don't care as well. So he was 89 at the time, I think. And I loved the non-PC-ness of it all. You know, just anything he wanted to say. If it was funny, he just said it. I loved it.
Yeah, yeah.
But also, that he had such he would never be mean about anyone. He would never punch down. I remember when he obviously didn't have a very good relationship with Grace Jones on A View to a Kill. Mm-hmm. And I think his quote about her is when he's asked about her, he always says, you know, my mum always said never, if you've got nothing nice to say about someone, don't say it. So I'll not say anything. That's how he would just deal with it and then move on. But what an experience to see him. So you never got to meet him personally, Mark?
No, but Matthew Vaughn, who directed Kingsman, had this really cool idea. And Sean Connery was still alive, Roger Moore was alive. And his idea was to do a promotional teaser for Kingsman, where you had all the previous Bonds together, all having a toast around the table kind of thing, you know, and talking about a new generation of spies. And he had this really cool little idea. And we actually had a link to everybody. We had, like, Roger Moore, I think, was good friends with somebody Matthew knew. I can't remember who it was. Colin Firth was friendly with Brosnan, and Matthew knew Daniel Craig from Layer Cake and everything, you know, and somebody knew Lazenby. And the idea was we kind of had all of them, and I think we actually had a slightly provisional yes, according to Matthew, I don't know if this is true, but we had a provisional yes from everyone, and we were trying to get Connery, and he tried to get me to get Connery because I was Scottish. And and as it turns out, we did have a mutual friend. And although I didn't know him, you know, I called up my mutual friend and he phoned ahead. But Connery was quite ill by that point, and we were told, like, okay, this just can't happen. And then I said, look, why don't we do what they did in the 60s and just get Neil Connery, his brother, and just use him if we can. But it would have been so cool. I mean, that would have been great just to see those guys actually standing together in real life.
It would have been absolutely massive as well.
As a teaser. Yeah. And you could have shot it in an hour. You know, you could have had them all just standing around a table, and the idea was they have this Kingsman whiskey that they toast, you know, and then the camera pans round and you see Colin, you know, and it's the or Taran, I can't remember who it was going to be, and it was just the next generation of super spies without, and it would have really annoyed the Broccolis, which would have been all.
Well, you still see that picture all the time where it's Brosnan, Roger. And is it Timothy?
And Dalton.
Oh, yes. With the beard and everything he's got.
It's such a famous picture. Because you look at it and think, oh, imagine being there and having a drink with them. That would have been fantastic.
But the worst idea in the world, though, was that rumour that was kicking about around about the Lee Tamahori time. But it props up occasionally, is the idea of making all the Bond movies in continuity. And there's a guy who takes on the role of James Bond instead of 007.
Yeah.
So they can all appear in one movie, which, you know, like every 5 years somebody touts that, don't they?
It's the James Bond verse.
Be another 20 years and they'll all get made at some point.
Well, the thing is, all those guys one by one are passing away, you know, so that does stop it, I guess, doesn't it? You know, they're probably missed the
window. It a bit.
I mean, it'll just be, it'll be Brosnan and Craig, really, once it? They'll be the last two.
Yeah.
Well, it's an interesting segue, actually, Mark. Good opening to talk about King of Spies, because I know when the artwork for King of Spies sort of first hit the web, everyone just said, well, that's Pierce Brosnan. because he had the beard and it's an old spy. Was that a deliberate input, or was that just coincidental?
Do you know, funnily enough, years ago, Ridley Scott called me up and he asked me if I would be interested in being one of 10 young directors to shoot a 15-minute short. And I came up with two ideas, right? And he said, you to write and direct. And I was like, I'd never directed anything. And he said, I think you'd be quite good at it because you're quite visual, you know? And he said, the budget was something like $100,000 or something, like a very small budget. So try and make it work and try and come up with something quite cool. And I had the idea of doing something actually with Timothy Dalton. I thought, I knew Dalton was a proper thesp and everything, you know? And I thought it'd be quite cool just to have a, you know, like Alan Bennett's Talking Heads? And it'd be really cheap to do. You could just basically give the whole $100,000 to Dalton for coming in for 2 hours, you know, and doing a 15-minute monologue, like sitting in a gentleman's club talking about his time as Britain's greatest spy and looking around at London now and being disappointed, is this what he fought for? And so I had this idea then, actually, for Dalton. You know, Brosnan would obviously be perfect. I mean, he's the character is exactly Brosnan's age. Physically, he looks so like him. And I actually think we've moved on from retro 80s into retro 90s now, although cinema hasn't quite caught up with that yet, you know. But that's the next cultural trend, isn't it? You know, like the 80s guys have shuffled on. You know, it's not that exciting to see Arnie or Sly or Bruce Willis so much anymore as a retro thing. You want to see those 90s guys, I think, now a little bit, you know, and it's the Kevin Costners and all that, and Yellowstone and everything, that's kind of quite exciting. So I think Brosnan is so perfect for this. He's so perfect. So we've been developing it with literally my favourite writer doing the screenplay for it, you know, who's amazing, and that's who we both want.
Wow.
Yeah, it's fantastic. We've been chatting about it quite a bit.
Oh, you're ready, yeah?
Yes.
Oh, cool,
yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, really nice. But we were just talking about Brosnan being absolutely perfect for the role.
And I think Brosnan, I feel, never got his Unforgiven, you know, or whatever. You know, he never, like, he's so beloved, and I think he went out on a bit of a low for Bond as well, which was so unfair because I think he was brilliant. And there was always the rumor, wasn't there? I mean, I would read this stuff, be so excited that Quentin Tarantino and Brosnan had had dinner. And I don't know if you guys have heard this, you know, that Tarantino was going to do Casino Royale and it was going to be Brosnan and everything. Yeah. And I was like, this is going to be the greatest thing ever. And I feel he was cheated out of his last super spy story. And I thought, wouldn't it be great to get Brosnan in for that one last job?
Yeah, we often talk. Brendan's got this dream that he's going to come back and they're going to do like a retro Bond series where it's all Brosnan. He's out of retirement. Pinning all his hopes on.
Well, that's King's Spy. But
yeah, exactly. Right? And so this would be the absolute dream, if you know.
Brosnan with a nice suit, a grey beard, holding a gun, standing with London behind him. You're like, okay, I'm in.
Well, I don't know if you saw, Mark, before we were recording, I've got a poster of Logan on my wall. That wasn't tactically placed here, but that's that picture of Hugh Jackman with the suit and with the claws. I can just see it with Pierce Brosnan and the guns and the old man Bond. Yeah. And it's funny that, like, you know, you were behind Old Man Logan, that then became the movie Logan. Yeah. It just feels like it's the perfect opportunity for them to do this. But I guess for you, it wouldn't be affiliated with Bond. It would be in tribute to Bond, I guess, wouldn't it?
Yeah, but kind of like, you know, you have Bill Money as a sort of analogue, isn't it, of the man with no name and Unforgiven. You know, you loved this guy 20 years ago and here he is for one last adventure. It's like it's such a classic trope, you know, like Rooster Cogburn is every John Wayne character you ever loved as an old man where he's lost his eye and everything, you know. So like, so I think even as a teenager, you love that stuff. I don't know why it's so powerful, but to see somebody who used to be a hero picking up a gun again and doing one last job, even when I was 16, I loved that. When I saw Batman, Frank Miller's book, The Dark Knight Returns, where it was like Adam West Batman 20 years on, and here he is as this big, fat, 50-year-old guy and everything, you know. It was, even as a 16-year-old, it was the coolest thing I'd ever seen.
So I was going to say, I was going to ask you about that. With Old Man Logan, what the response from the comic community, was it much like, you know, everybody, all the young comic fans loved it as much as the older fans?
Oh, my God. I mean, mainly the younger ones, yeah, absolutely. I mean, comic fans historically used to have a turnover every 3 years or so. You know, it was always new people coming in. But you do find it's more long-term people now, like me, you know, people who grew up in the 80s and everything, still reading comics. But when you go to a convention, it's 90%, you know, people under 30, really. You know, it's definitely a younger crowd. But Old Man Logan, it's the biggest selling Wolverine graphic novel ever. Yeah, so I mean, I think it's Marvel's number two graphic novel ever. You know, so it really works with young people. You know, it seems
that's interesting, because when No Time to Die came out, mm-hmm. I was skeptical, because back in the, you know, the Roger Moore days, yeah. and the Sean Connery days, pin-up actors were older.
Yeah,
there weren't loads of young actors around, so. I was when the Casino Royale came out, he was still a little bit older then. I was thinking, did the world want older actors in those sort of roles, or is it going to be the older fan base that loves them and the younger people don't watch them? But it's clearly not the case with the latest Bond films.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Like, I mean, somebody was telling me sort of the tracking on Tom Cruise's new movie, you know, the Top Gun sequel, and the tracking suggests that it may be Tom Cruise's biggest movie ever, you know, and you think he was the biggest star of the 80s, 90s, noughties, and the teenies, or whatever it's called. And he, this could be his biggest as he hits 60, which is just so crazy, isn't it? But then I guess 20 years ago, movie stars were replaced by corporate brands, possibly quite intentionally. I think it was a couple of things. One of them is social media and the internet, I guess, in general, made us see celebrities 24/7, so they seem much less interesting. Whereas they could control how you saw Spider-Man or control how you saw Aragorn from Lord of the Rings, you know? So, but they were the last generation of movie stars, weren't they? Those 90s guys. There isn't really anybody since that can open a movie the way Pitt or Cruise or Will Smith or those guys could do.
King of Spies, then, you sort of suggested that it's being developed already for the screen. Is that with Netflix, and are you thinking a feature film or series, or is it not got that far yet?
Well, it's funny, actually. What I used to do was I used to write a comic book and then turn it into a film, you know, so I'd take it to friends or to studios or whatever, you know, and we'd make it into a movie. But I sold my company, Miller Worlds, about 4 years ago to Netflix. So now I'm a Netflix executive, you know, so what I do is I create the stuff in-house. So I'm president of the Miller World division within Netflix, you know. So what I do is once I sold the company, I did a deal where I stayed on also as an executive. And I would create new properties as movies and TV shows, but also do them as comics. So it's kind of the reverse now, you know, like I create them as a show or as a movie. But because I love doing comics so much, Netflix aren't bothered either way, you know, but I say, look, I love comics. Do you mind if I do a 4-issue series of this or whatever? So the comic actually comes second. So we've been making the television show for longer than the comic has been out there. So it's not an adaptation. It's actually almost an adaptation of a television show, the comic book.
And is there a lot of those you're working on at the moment?
I mean, when I sold the company, there was 17 franchises. Kingsman and Kick-Ass, I left out of it just to make things not complicated for Matthew Vaughn, you know, because he's a good pal of mine. So we have that, we still own that, and it's a distinct entity. But the other 17 franchises that was within Millerworld was sold to Netflix. And then I've maybe since then created 6 things, I think. So there's Magic Order, Space Bandits, Sharky the Bounty Hunter, Prodigy, King of Spies, and I think something else. And we're working on all of those things at the same time as doing the adaptations of the television, of the comic books. So it's really weird. I mean, there's a crazy amount of stuff. We're doing about 7 TV shows and 3 movies all simultaneously, you know, so it's a lot of work.
So you think this one is a limited series, do you think, then?
Yes. Yeah, that's certainly the way it's being developed, you know. Like, I mean, I originally intended it as a feature, actually, because it was a nice 3-act structure. But the writer that we got in, it was me who wanted him, he's an absolute genius. He was like, no, I think there's a lot we can explore here. You know, this feels like a good solid 6 hours to me, and there's a lot of background stuff we can go into and everything. We could go a little deeper. And he's, you know, the scripts are brilliant.
So have you made contact with Brosnan?
No, I think we're gonna get the scripts all finalised and as good as they can possibly be, and then go to Brosnan, though. You know? So,
like, 'cause, I mean, he must be aware.
Well, people keep copying him into tweets and things so I'm sure he's seen it. Yeah. But, I mean, I adore Brosnan, you know. I mean, if this could lead to a pint with Brosnan, I'd be happy with that. You know?
Well, even if he wasn't going to be involved, it's a very exciting prospect.
Yeah.
It lends itself very nicely to a very exciting format.
There's a very small number of people that could play Britain's retired greatest ever super spy, you know? Like, yeah. You could probably do Hugh Jackman, but he's done Logan. You know, Australians can pull it off as well, can't they? Like, you can get away with Australians and New Zealanders, but you couldn't get an American playing this part, you know, because somebody suggested an American actor, and it feels like, you know, that Jimmy Bonds pilot they made in the 50s. It feels like that.
Yeah, we were saying Clive Owen, because he was the guy that famously didn't get it when Daniel Craig got it. He would be a good fit, possibly. Possibly a bit too young, but...
There's a lot of nearly Bonds, isn't there? You know, but I think you probably have to be in your 60s for this, though. I think Clive Owen's still a little... He's still a little vital. He could almost still play Bonds, couldn't he, Clive Owen? Yeah.
Mm. Whereas we also mentioned Liam Neeson.
Well, do you know what's funny? I mean, I'm the biggest Neeson fan in the world, but I don't know if he looks like an old Etonian. I don't know if you'd buy him as an old Etonian, you know, which I think there's got to be the guy who came from this world that's gone now, and he's looking around and he absolutely doesn't understand the modern world. But I feel that Neeson fits in quite well, you know, like, even though he's an older guy and everything, you kind of, you're like, yeah, you get people, you're still kind of cool, you know? Mm. Whereas I think there's got to be that double cuffs and old school tie and all that look to this character, I think, because he's got to be completely lost almost in the modern world, but he finds his mojo after he finds out he's got a brain tumor. Actually, I should say, you know, the concept of the thing is Britain's greatest ever spy suddenly finds out he's going to die. He's lost. He's done nothing for 20 years. He's ashamed of what he's done. Some terrible things in the past too, as an MI6 agent. And he decides to kill everyone who deserves to die. And he knows where all the bodies are buried. So he knows the royal princes who've been abusing people. He knows about the corrupt presidents and prime ministers and popes and things. And he kills them all. So it's a ton of fun.
It's very on the nose as well. Some of the people that he goes after. Which, some of the things I think you got.
Corruption never goes out of style.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's terrific, and it really lends itself to being seen on the screen. And also, you touch on a lot of Bond tropes as well, I think, which is brilliant. You've got the the physically memorable henchman. You've got a gadget lair where you can pick up any gadget that can do anything. So it's clear that from the reading it that you really love this world,
but just different enough to make it not a direct link to it. I actually find it hard to read things like this because I'm constantly just trying to pick it apart and go, right, that's that person.
Well, not a court case. You don't want it to be a court case. But at the same time, you know, you've got your pre-credit sequence, you've got your, even at the end of the pre-credit sequence, there's a slightly misty psychedelic swirl in the water and everything, you know. You've got exotic locations, like you say, a physically challenged henchman, you know. And then the baddie and the big boss at the end in the place where he feels safest, with the spy coming into the place he feels safest. Do you know, it's funny, I mean, Kingsman touches on a lot of that stuff as well, and a lot of the actors we talked about for Kingsman to play the Colin Firth role in Kingsman. Matthew always says, oh yeah, these were the people I planned all along, but obviously there's these discussions where there was loads of people to discuss before anyone accepted it. But weirdly, they're all in that age group as well, you know, where who would be good for this. There's a lot of really brilliant British actors in their 60s. Not so many, you know, in their 20s and 30s, but that was kind of the last of those British movie stars, wasn't it? Those guys who are about 58 to 68. They're really brilliant guys, like Gary Oldman and all that as well.
You do have the opportunity to cast a super spy in their prime as well, from the comic. So you must have given that some thought as well.
Yeah, like somebody like Tom Hiddleston or somebody like that would be great. You know, somebody somebody who doesn't feel like a copy of Bond but has Bond's DNA in him. You know, like and Hiddleston's got that, but he doesn't feel. I always think Hiddleston's an unusual choice for Bond itself. He doesn't quite seem like Bond to me, but he feels almost Bond. But he's actually very interesting as well, and I think history hasn't been kind in some ways to the Bonds, because it's such a huge role, like Superman, that it kind of overshadows the rest of your career. And some people are really brilliant actors who don't get a chance to shine in other things. I think Hiddleston, by not getting Bonds, could actually have a much more interesting career. Like, I think he could have 30 years of playing lots of different parts and he's maybe too varied an actor to be Bond as well, you know. So like, but he'd be great to be this guy's son. I mean, somebody like Hiddleston would just be so bang on. I did a pee beside Hiddleston once. I remember in that.
I wasn't expecting this.
It was at a comic convention. It was one of those things, and I was aware that people were quite excited that Hiddleston was standing urinating beside everyone. The first Thor movie was just about to come out, but they didn't want to ask for a selfie because he literally was standing urinating. So it was one of those very British moments, you know, where like, at what point do you wait till he shake? Is he once he's shook? Once he's washed his hands, once he's dried his hands, when do you do the photograph? And I saw this cluster of men waiting behind him while he was urinating.
It's not a scenario I've ever thought about happening, but now you mention it, I think, yeah, I would be in the same position.
There's that famous story, isn't there, of Jake Gyllenhaal at Sundance, I think it was at Sundance, where he got into a fight with someone who tried to get a photo of him in the toilet. you just got to wait. Just got to wait.
Roger wouldn't have minded.
No. I wanted to touch on King. Go on, Mark. Sorry.
I was just going to say the only other famous person I've urinated beside was Will Ferrell once. It was in a studio meeting. I had a meeting and I nipped off to the toilet during the meeting and he was in there at the same time. And what I was surprised at is how tall he is. He's actually like 6'4" or something. He's much taller than I expected. And I walked out of the toilet and said to the studio exec, like, I just saw Will Ferrell in there. He's enormous. And he came out right behind me and went, thank you very much, and just walked on. It was absolutely amazing. It was so smooth. It was a real Roger Moore line. It was perfect.
I just wanted to touch on Kingsman, Mark, because you mentioned it there. I saw, I don't know where I read it, but it said that Kingsman started life as a pub chat with Matthew Vaughan about how James Bond movies were really boring and serious and how he missed the funny Roger Moore ones.
Yeah.
Was there something that tipped you both over the edge?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it was on the Kick-Ass set, actually. There was a little pub near Elstree where Kick-Ass was filmed and there was some setup going on and Matthew and I nipped off for a quick pint and just... We chat about everything. I mean, we gossip every day on the phone, you know, and Matthew said to me, I'm so bored with Bond now, you know, it's like I miss funny Bond and everything. We were talking about all that. And I said, I've got this idea for a Bond thing. And he said, I've got a James Bond origin idea. And I said, so do I, you know. And his was a posh James Bond origin sort of thing, which I think is probably quite like the King's Man movie, you know. And mine's was actually, I wanted to juxtapose the two worlds, you know. So I was saying, like, I'd adapted it from this idea I had for Nick Fury. You know who Nick Fury is? You know, the spy in the Marvel movies? So my idea, this was years ago, like 1998, I pitched this thing to Marvel, which was Nick Fury taking on his young nephew, you know, and sort of training him up to be an agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. kind of thing. And I kind of like that idea of somebody coming from the wrong end of the tracks, like Nick Fury came from Hell's Kitchen, you know, and that idea that he then gets trained up and becomes a super smooth spy, you know. So the ideas got blended just over time, over chats. And then Jane Goldman wrote like the most awesome screenplay and everything. It was one of those things where everything was perfect. It just couldn't have worked out better. And, you know, I loved the first film. I actually got paid more for the second and third films, even though I had nothing to do with them because I was off working at Netflix at that point, you know. So the first one's the only one I really feel any real identity of me in, you know. But I think it works out really well. I'm really happy with that one.
It's got that For Your Eyes Only style poster as well, hasn't it? I always remember that.
That was Matthew's idea, actually. Matthew came up with that. There was a few like mocked up versions that he showed me and I was like, that's so audacious. You know, the idea of going in through the gazelle's legs and everything is instead of Bod Adams' legs was so cool. There was a kind of mock-up poster that I didn't think would be the final poster and I actually saw it all the way through, you know, like... It was almost a bit of an internal gag amongst us, you know, like whenever the screenplay was going about, that was on the front of it, you know, for a while. It was brilliant. When posters are kind of dull, aren't they? Posters are usually a big close-up of somebody's face. It's quite nice to have something that's just a little bit different, isn't it?
They were really distinctive, those ones, with the very very crisp and clear images, weren't they? I thought they were really cool.
Yeah.
We won't hold you up for much longer. I just wanted to ask you, you're obviously, you oversaw a lot of the Fox movies while you were working with them on their Marvel movies. If you were to do, offered the chance to do something similar for Bond, because obviously we're coming into a new cycle with Bond,
Yeah.
Where would you start? What would your sort of advice be to the people looking to make the next Bond?
I think you've got to look at what works in the past and then try and figure out, you know, like why was it exciting when this guy became James Bond? And it's because it's different from what came before. And Daniel Craig was very exciting. I mean, you remember it was enormous, the idea of like somebody who was a bit of a ginger, so a little bit smaller, a bit more squat looking and everything, you know, playing James Bond. It was. I remember when Michael Keaton was cast as Batman, it was all people talked about for like 2 months. Even though superhero movies weren't in vogue at the time, people were like, he's only 5'8". How could he be Batman? You know, so actually casting against what people are used to can be really interesting. So the idea of going funny again, I think, is the way to go. And I know there'll be all the, you know, on Her Majesty's Secret Service purists, you know, listening to this, you know, so I think that's the worst thing ever. But I'd love to feel excited about a Bond film again. Like, I went to see Batman a few weeks ago, and I went almost kind of just because I felt I should, you know, and I feel like that a bit with Bond just now as well, where I had no joy in my heart at all going to see the new Bond film. You know, I felt I had to, like everybody else had seen it. I thought, I suppose I should go now too. And, you know, I'm sure there's nobody listening to this that hasn't seen it, you know, so in terms of spoilers, the death at the end, if I was connected up to an electroencephalogram, you would not have detected one single change in my pulse or heart rate. Or you know, I felt absolutely nothing at the end of that film. Yeah. And I've loved James Bond all my life, you know. So, I mean, Bond dying almost off camera and everything, you know, it just felt so flat to me, you know. So, but everybody's ready, I think. People were ready for a new Bond 5 years ago, I think. I would just make it a great night out again, going to see a Bond film. And I'd make it that when kids come out of the film, one, kids should go and see it, same as Batman. Like, the idea of a Batman film that nobody under 15 can go and see is preposterous, you know? So the idea of James Bond, I think, that an 8-year-old can't get in is ludicrous. So kids should come out of Bond wanting the car and wearing a holster under their school blazer again, you know? Like, you should want to be James Bond. I think that's so important, isn't it?
Is that a common thing, the holster under the school blazer? I'm sure we would have got told off of that.
In Glasgow, it's just survival. You know?
Oh, right, yeah, okay. Are you thinking, would your preference be that we go back to that sort of one-shot film where there's no long-term storyline that's padding out, really just make them fun and in the moment?
My God, yes. I would actually make it against the law to make a film over 2 hours now. As well, I think you should need a note from the president or something like that if you're going to make a film over 2 hours long. Like, a Bond film should be about 155 and utterly self-contained, so that if you watch the fourth one, the second one, the third one, and then the first one, it all makes perfect sense. And to me, that's good business as well. You know, I think the interconnected movie with 2 or 3 years between each film is the most, especially for a 5 or 6 movie. Series is just preposterous. Harry Potter and all that stuff had the good sense to have a movie out every year, you know, but when you're waiting 3 years between each one, it's crazy. Or 5 years in the case of Bond.
Yeah.
Well, if you were to do a spin-off of one of the characters from any of the Bond films, who would you go for?
None of them. Like, I would never do a like, the world does not need a Felix Leiter movie, you know. We don't need a Miss Moneypenny movie. We don't need Jaws, how he lost his teeth. You know, we don't need any of these things. It's hard enough every 2.5 years to do a great James Bond film, you know? So I would just put everything into doing the best James Bond film every 2 to 3 years out there, you know? And never do...
I've had that same argument with these guys before, and I've said exactly the same thing. Yeah. We don't want origin stories from all of the extra characters.
Nobody cares, you know? It's like, what's weird is whenever you're obsessed with something or you're working on something... Everybody thinks that's what you want. Like, a super fast example is I did a movie in 2008 called Wanted, and it cost $70 million and it made $340 million, right? So the studio was like, we need more of these. And they said, but Angelina Jolie dies at the end of the film, so we should make it a prequel and da-da-da. Nobody cares. Nobody cares where she came from. She died in that film. Yeah. Go and do something else, you know? So,
and that's part of the charm of Bond, isn't it? You don't care. You don't know what these people are from. It's just, it's a character that exists in time.
We love him, you know? And like Han Solo, you don't want to see him as a kid. You don't want to see him with his dad and all that stuff. You know, I think an icon should be intact. I think the minute you explain him away, you lose him. And that's what worries me with Amazon, because I hate the idea of a young James Bond TV series, a middle-aged James Bond TV series, spin-offs of all the characters. Because I think the reason it's lasted six decades is because its scarcity gives it value.
Yes.
Yeah.
I agree.
Man, that sounded so wise, didn't it? That sounded really
wise. It did, yeah.
Well, it's interesting, Mark, because obviously you're in a similar boat. You've just, you've become part of this big sort of internet firm with all this money behind them. So for you, it feels like it's allowed you a lot more creativity. So maybe, hopefully, with Eon, that's what they might get as well, hopefully.
Yeah, it's funny, like, Bond's a family business, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, and whenever a family business gets bought over, it can go off the rails. You know, that's my concern. You know, like, I hope it retains what makes us love it, because the minute big American companies get their fingers in it, technology companies, they could destroy everything that makes it work. I think they've almost in the last few years destroyed, last 10 years, they've probably destroyed a lot of what makes Bond work for me. You know, and they're a bit embarrassed by it. I mean, how many of these films start with, he's a dinosaur, you know? It's like, you know, it's like, he's not a dinosaur. He's actually like a really valid current character who everybody loves, you know? And he's in his prime, you know? Yeah. So I hope they don't clean him up too much. I remember years ago, there was a thing that was very popular in the 1930s and then popular with Roger Moore again in the 60s called The Saint. And Ian Ogilvy made it big in the 70s and 80s as well. And it was, I mean, that thing ran for six decades. It was huge. George Saunders did it back in the 30s. And the novels, Leslie Charteris' novels, were enormous. And then they cleaned them up. They brought them back, I think, in the 90s. And they made them eco-friendly. They made them really care about the environment. So he didn't smoke and he didn't have flash cars. He cycled everywhere. And he was utterly monogamous, you know. And everybody hated it. You know? So, like, I hope nothing like that happens to Bond now that Amazon have got their hands on it.
So if it was you, you want a Henry Cavill type, someone that can tell a joke and do the action.
Well, you want five films.
In an hour and a half.
Yeah, well, and I'd give it an hour and 50. An hour and 50. If there's a really important scene, an hour and 55. You know? But I think it's funny because you can pretty much guess who's going to be Bond by their age. They're not going to cast a 28-year-old and they're not going to cast a 45-year-old because they want to get five films out of them and it takes 2 or 3 years to make each film. So 38 is about perfect and Cavill is so bang on that age that I think it would be weird almost for it not to be Cavill. I almost can't imagine who else they could pick. I mean, what about you guys? Have you got somebody in mind?
Oh, many debates floating about. I think it depends on how you think. We have a lot of discussions about the angle that they should go with it. Mm-hmm. And there's a big thought that they should go period and take it back to like the 60s. You know, you're shaking your head at that one.
The thing is, purists love it, you know, but if you do a period action movie, you're struggling. You know, like, and even Indiana Jones was a successful period action movie, but you have to remember it was set only 40 years prior to the release. So that's the equivalent of now the 80s. You know, so 1981 to Indiana Jones, it's actually just a generation and a half, you know? Mm. So anything set before the 80s, you really struggle to get mainstream audiences to come in and watch. It's really hard. Because I've had pals who said, oh, I'd love to do a film noir Batman, which would look incredible, or a 60s set spy movie like Bond in the 60s. But see, trying to get especially under 25s to go and see something. I think especially when it's a genre thing, there's something quite interesting about action set before, you know, present day is a really hard sell. Like, cinema's littered with things that didn't work, you know, like The Phantom or The Rocketeer and all these films that people have got a fondness for, but they didn't make money, Dick Tracy and everything. There's something, I don't know if it's maybe a thing where you're kind of worried about the character on screen, where you feel like he's not going to fall off that building because that was 1938 and he's probably fine now, you know, like that happened in the past. Maybe something has to be super current for you to believe and get caught up in it, you know? So, I mean, I personally, I would love a 1963 set Bond movie, but I think I'd be very scared to invest $200 million in it.
It's always difficult to think about the age of these films and how far ago. I forget that the 80s is a long time ago now.
Yeah.
I think it's relatively recent.
Even the 90s. I mean, I was on a train a little while ago, and maybe 5 years ago, and I heard these students talking about 90s night, and they said, oh, there's 90s night at the university, are you going? And they said, I've nothing to wear. And they said, just wear your mum and dad's old stuff, you know, and that was me. So you have to remember, you know, like the '60s is like your great grandfather if you're a current member of the audience. You know?
God, yeah, yeah.
That's like, you, that's like us watching something set in the Crimean War, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, and you, like I said, you can't get your Nokia product tie-ins either in the 1960s, so you're going to struggle.
Well, League of Extraordinary Gentlemen was the big one where they spent a lot of money. I mean, that was an expensive movie, and it was set in Victorian times, and the big gadget they had was a car, you know, and everybody was like, wow, you know, there's a car going by, but audiences were like, I'm leaving the cinema, you know. So.
That was the movie that made Sean Connery quit acting. So,
I know.
How sad. Well, we won't keep you for any longer, Mark. But where can people find you if they want to keep up with what you're doing online? I know you've got a newsletter now.
Yeah, if anybody wants to see a marketing department pretending to be me, they can catch me on Twitter. And Facebook and Instagram. But meanwhile, I'll just be like watching something funny on YouTube. I won't actually be the person replying to anyone, you know, but it's there if anybody wants to see it. I have a newsletter you can sign up to if you go to my website. It's mrmarkmiller.com, and there's a sort of weekly newsletter. I've always said, like, I would never write one unless there was something to actually talk about or something to promote or whatever, you know, because you don't want to just hear what I've had for my dinner and things like that, you know. So there's usually about 3 a month or something like that, and they're kind of all right. And they're free. You know, everything you have to sign up for now, Substack and all that, like, mines are free, so that's the big selling point.
And if people want to get hold of the podcast, guys?
Email us at podcast@jamesbondatoz.co.uk.
And on the social media, @JamesBondA to Z. That's on Instagram, Facebook and Twitter.
Just want to say thank you so much to our guest, Mr. Mark Miller. Mark, it's been a genuine honour having you on. We're huge fans of your comics. And yeah, just really appreciate you taking the time to come on and talk about James Bond for an hour. So yeah, thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me, and have me back when we do the live action version of King of Spies. We'll talk about it.
Well, we're coming down to set. We're on our way.
Yes. Yeah. Wouldn't it be great if we did it with Brosnan? We're all out in the piss with Brosnan. That'd be brilliant.
Oh, don't. Damn.
No, we're starting off now.
We're starting the King of Spies podcast next, just so that we can do that. But yeah, it just leaves me to say that the James Bond A to Z podcast will return next week. Thank you, Mark Miller.
Thanks a lot.
Ciao.
James Bond A to Z podcast features Tom Butler, Brendan Duffy and Tom Wheatley. The podcast was produced by Tom Wheatley, with music by Tom Ingemels, and artwork supplied by Helen Dolly.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy 5 or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.